Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to Lessons in Leadership, our new Leaders in Law podcast.
On this episode, you'll hear a discussion on a variety of topics pertaining to women in leadership.
This episode features speakers Jane Swift, Aaron Murphy Rafferty, Karen Frederick, and Boak Malone. We hope you enjoy.
So I'm sure some more people will file in at some point, but we're just going to go ahead and start for now. So welcome to Leaders in Law, the Women in Leadership discussion. I'm Bridget Provo, and it's my distinct pleasure to welcome you to tonight's event. Now, before we delve into our discussion with our fabulous panel, I'm just going to give a quick overview on Leaders in Law. So Leaders was founded by me and my classmate, Daniel, when we were freshmen in high school in 2017. And it's a nonprofit speaker series positioned to educate, inspire, and connect the greater Lowell community with information, valuable leaders, and each other. Both Daniel and I are very excited to be able to carry out this mission tonight with our panel. We'll be covering a number of topics in having to do with women, community involvement, cross-field collaboration, and leadership. So joining us tonight to lend their expertise in these areas are former Governor Jane Swift, the Wonder Fund CEO Aaron Murphy Rafferty, Enterprise Bank Vice President Boak Malone, and Community Teamwork CEO Karen Frederick. All of these inspirational leaders have ample knowledge and experience in the fields of nonprofit, government, and business. We are honored to have them join us tonight. We would also like to thank the Merrimack Repertory Theater and Mr. and Mrs. Drew Photography for their kind support, which has made this event possible. Now, without further ado, let's get to the discussion.
Well, thank you all for coming tonight. Thank you all for being with us tonight. So could each of you just share a little bit about your career and about just who you are? And we'll start with Karen down at the end.
All right. Sure, and first, is this on, we think?
Should be.
Should we? Yeah, we good? Okay, I have a loud voice too. Everyone keeps me quiet. I just want to thank Daniel and Bridget for this. You know, you guys are you know, you don't often see young people taking the initiative to do this and to really put the time in, so congratulations to you too. I'm Karen Frederick, I'm the Chief Executive Officer at Community Teamwork. For those of you who don't know, Community Teamwork is a community action agency and a regional housing agency serving Middlesex and Essex County. Our headquarters are here in Lowell. We provide services for over 50,000 people every year, and it's education, opportunities in the housing world. We work with homeless families, but all of our services are geared towards helping people become and remain economically independent. So it's a lot of workforce connections, training. We work with young kids, seniors, all ages, and we are funded by state, federal, and local funding sources. So I came to this, and I really hate to say how many years ago I started in this field, but I started at Community Teamwork over 40 years ago. And I thought I'd stay a little bit and then move on to something else. And I had just gotten my master's in education. And then, you know, I kind of connected with the work here in Lowell. I grew up in Chelmsford. I had kind of a traditional upbringing, went right to college, went right to graduate school after that, and then became a single parent. And I had four kids under the age of six, and realized that life can turn in a moment, and that you never really know, right? I thought I had things on track, not so much. So I used government services myself for a period of time in my life, and that really cemented the passion for work, for helping people move forward in their lives, because for me, I had an education, a supportive family, lots of friends. I grew up here. I had all the supports I needed, and yet I was scared to death that my life was going to not be able to go forward. So that's sort of what brought me to this work and keeps me at this work. I have had lots of experiences that I know we're going to talk about being a woman in leadership, some good, some not so good. And I'm sure we'll hear a lot about that tonight. So with that, I'll turn it over to our former governor.
So thank you for having me here this evening. You didn't have us arranged in a particular way, and I just realized I think we may have done it based on the number of years in our career. We just did it that way.
Right.
But we almost did it by number of children. These guys needed to flip it. We have three parents of twins here, we decided, in the green room. But I am Jane Swift, and I'm also going to apologize because I'm doing something that you all would get in trouble if you did it in school, and I don't allow my children do, and I'm also going to make you all any of you who are old enough to remember me, some of you weren't born during this, but I'm going to keep my phone out for a little while because one of my twins is driving here from Western Massachusetts to pick me up this evening. That's what's going to make you feel old, that I have a twin who's old enough to drive. She is not a baby anymore. And she doesn't often drive into Lowell, although she's been to Lowell a number of times, so just in case she doesn't find the marquee parking garage, I told her she could text, not call. But she assures me she has it under control. But I am Jane Swift. I've been honored to hold leadership positions in the public and the private sector. I served as the state senator from my hometown and got into it for similar reasons. I was very lucky to grow up in a working class family who really instilled in me and my siblings the importance of being involved in your community, gave me leadership opportunities in high school. I volunteered on political campaigns with my dad when I was in middle school and high school. And those experiences, like Bridget, like you guys are having now, Daniel, really do start to form how you think about your place in a community and in the world. When I was out of college, I worked for my state senator and was encouraged to run for office at a relatively young age, and that gave me enormous opportunities to, most importantly, help to improve the public education system in Massachusetts, which was really important to me because for me, my siblings, my cousins, that's what really gave us opportunity to do well and move beyond our local community to serve. Since then, I've been given opportunities to serve on boards where you don't find enough women. Oftentimes, I am still the first woman. More often than not now, I'm not the only woman. Sometimes I'm the first, but not the only, and I think that's important. I've been given wonderful opportunities to mentor younger women. I have done that through some women's initiatives on the national level with Deloitte, and then just in the work that I do as a CEO in the education field or in my board roles, and then on some nonprofit organizations as well. And Aaron actually was a very young volunteer and then worker in the governor's office way back in the day, and so it's a real pleasure to be on this panel with her tonight. I think that might come in. That's not my daughter. That would really make us all feel good. The cough sounded like her, though.
So good evening, everyone. My name is Bopa Malone. I want to thank Bridget and Daniel for putting this on. I'm so proud of you both. I'm so surprised that you're in high school. And I really want to thank all of you for being here this evening to join us and allow us to share about ourselves. And I hope we get to learn from you as well. So I am a mother of two, a daughter, Tavy, who is 8, and a son, Kaylin, who is 6, and we live in Bedford with my husband, Tom. And I work at Enterprise Bank for the past 10 years, well, actually 13 years now. Yesterday was my anniversary. I keep on saying 10 years, but it's really 13 years. what's really cool about my work, so for those of you that don't know Enterprise Bank, we are located, our headquarters is here in Lowell. We're in the Merrimack Valley, southern New Hampshire, central Mass. We have 24 branches. We're a $4 billion bank in asset management. And it's my first and only job, and I love it. I love it because of the fact that every day I get to make a difference. By working in the greater Lowell community, I've been able to help people get into their homes for the first time and building their businesses or expanding. And every day whenever I drive around the community, I see that without me or us advocating for these people to be able to have these opportunities, they wouldn't be able to have a leg up, or you know, so for me, I've been really, really proud to be able to do that. And in addition to that, for over 13 years, I've been a community activist as well. I've been serving on a number of nonprofit boards, educational board. I'm on Middlesex Community College, my alma mater, Lesley University, and a couple of women empowering boards as well. You know, and I'm really just, I'm very, very blessed to be where I am today, because if you were to tell me when I was a little girl living in the Thai refugee camp that one day I would have this life and to sit in front of you and to share my story, I wouldn't believe it. So my parents went through the Khmer Rouge regime. For those of you that don't know about the Khmer Rouge regime, it's basically a group of Cambodians, communists, who took over the country and killed 2 million of their own people. So my parents witnessed all of that, experienced all of that, and luckily I was born right after. But even though I was born right after, they knew that there was no opportunity there. And my first memory was when my mother walked me on foot from Cambodia to Thailand and to escape the country. And thinking, why is it that my mother wants to kill me? Because I remember being a 3-year-old child and being hungry and crying for food. And then my mom was putting her hand over my mouth, and I was thinking that she was suffocating me, when in reality, she was trying to calm me down so we wouldn't get caught. My childhood was in the Thai refugee camp, and luckily in 1989, we had an opportunity to come here to the US. I grew up in Lynn, and even though you know, Lynn was a much better place than the Thai refugee camp, where we grew up, it was in the 90s, it was gang infested. There was a lot of teen pregnancy back then. But luckily, I was able to connect with a great organization called Girls Incorporated. If you don't know about Girls Inc., it's an organization that empowers girls to become strong, smart, and bold. And because of them, their mentorship, like Jane was talking about, it's so important. You know, just small things, where growing up not believing that I can do things, or knowing that I had potential, but someone else told me that I can do it and I do have potential. And because of them, I was able to get into college, stayed in college, completed, and get a job. And coming here to Lowell, and I'll tell you that story later, but I'm just so blessed at where I am and to be able to do what I do. And it was Girls Inc. who instilled in me the value of giving back. So, and I love working for Enterprise Bank, where one of our values is community. And every day, that's what I get to do, is to be able to help others through the bank and through all of my nonprofit work and making their life a better, being able to help them create their success and their dreams.
I'll just be very brief. But my name is Erin Murphy Rafferty, and I'm the CEO of the Wonder Fund. And yes, as Governor Swift mentioned, I still can't bring myself to call her Jane. My first job out of college was on the Salute G. Swift campaign in 1998. And that was absolutely life-changing for me and changed the trajectory of my life. First of all, seeing and watching an amazing, smart female leader day in and day out, who was happened to be pregnant and running for lieutenant governor, which was just so, like, what? was absolutely incredible. And without overtly communicating the fact that we really can do anything, I just had it in my brain and my subconscious that I can do anything. I didn't realize that was possible until I saw it in action. And I am now fortunate to know one of Jane's daughters, and who actually has minded my own children, which is so amazing to me. And it's just an incredible thing, this power of mentorship, the power of strong female role models for young women, young people, boys included.
is extremely important and truly life-changing. And just very quickly, post the very successful 1998 campaign, I worked in the administration for a bit and then went into the private sector working on the crisis communications team for Polaroid Corporation when they were filing for bankruptcy, which was a historic event in American history and local history. And then from there went and combined the private sector and public sector experience that I had and worked for the Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce for 9 years where I ran communications and strategic planning. And then I moved abroad. I met a guy. I moved to Ireland after having met my now husband. And consulted there for a few years for companies who are interested, European countries who are interested in doing work in the United States, and that was a phenomenal experience. And now I'm back. I have 3 children, 3 years old and 2 5-month-old twins. I have which is exactly the same family composition as the Swift family composition, which is really wonderful because not only is she a professional mentor to me, but she's also a mommy mentor to me, and it's really very special.
That's cute.
That's really special. And I'm running the Wonder Fund, and I've been doing this for the past year and a half. It's a wonderful organization that focuses exclusively on serving children who are engaged with the Department of Children and Families. And there's unfortunately 53,000 children today in Massachusetts who are involved with DCF. And in a given year, it's about over 100,000 children who have cycled through some sort of involvement with DCF. And right now, about 11,000 of those children are in foster care. And it's been, all know, these kids don't have the same opportunities or resources than other children do. So the Wonder Fund really works to help them in their emergency situation when they're being removed from their home because it's unsafe and they've been through trauma. And in addition to that, once they're engaged with DCF, we try to provide them with enrichment opportunities like playing sports, taking ballet, taking SAT prep, so that they have the same opportunities and just can feel like a kid, like every child deserves. And so I feel very fortunate to be able to combine all of this experience with nonprofit, with the private sector and the public sector, and use it to fuel a passion project of mine, which is helping children through the Wonder Fund. So I'm just so honored to be here. I'm batting cleanup for this, the power team right here. So I'm here if you need me, but go for it. This is a great channel.
Well, thank you all so much for coming. You all have such amazing and impressive stories. We're just honored to have you here to speak with us and speak with our audience. And we're going to be broadcasting this on LTC, so a lot of people will be able to see that as well. So just to start off, do you have any role models or people you admire who exemplify your definition of leadership?
Me? Bert? I think we're fortunate here in Lowell. We have some fabulous women leaders. I'm just going to stay local because I think, when I started as a CEO of Community Teamwork, most of the leaders in other organizations were men, and that has really changed. The university chancellor is a woman here. Our health center is run by a woman. The superintendent is a woman. I think we have really seen a dramatic change, and I think these are women who really all are similar. I mean, powerful women who have had many roles in the community. And I think we all kind of look up to each other and work together well, and I think that's really saying something. And for me, one of the women who really pushed me way back was my Nana. And I think we all have one of those people in our lives who kind of told us, you can do whatever you want. My mom didn't get the opportunity to go to college, neither did my grandmother. She didn't finish school. And yet, those were the people who said to me, go for it. When I ran for office for a local school committee. I'm thinking, why am I doing this? I have 4 kids and a full-time job, and I was teaching at night because I needed money. It was like, sure, you can do that. We'll help you. So you think about those women who didn't have opportunities, and I think that's a lot who pushed me forward.
So I used to hate this question when I was in elected office because I felt like there should be a perfect answer, and I also hated a lot of the pregnancy questions that Aaron and I were talking about, that there was never any good answer for, because no matter what you said, you were going to offend somebody with your answer. And I remember preparing for an interview, and this is just how bizarre my life was at some point. And I was chatting with my mom, and I had a young single guy, Jason Copey, who's still not young, but single. And he was writing all these questions for 60 Minutes, was coming to interview me about whether or not I could possibly have three children under, you know, the age of three and run the state. Good question. And he was like trying to give me answers, and I'm like, none of these answers, right? Like, I cannot say half of them with a straight face, right? Like, no woman in the world is going to believe them, which, of course, he's like 27 years old and does not have a uterus. And so I was like talking to my mom, who is and was, right, the stay-at-home mom, the brownie leader, the PTO president. Like, I would sit at her sewing machine in fifth grade, and it would smoke. So we were like, all right, not going to be the sewing. Like, to this day, she still makes all the Halloween costumes when there needs to be them. And so, like, she's like, what you see is the ideal, perfect stay-at-home mom, but I had nowhere else to go. So I'm like, Mom, you're going to ask me all these questions. You're asking me who my role model is, blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, what am I going to say? And she said, just tell them it's hard to be first. And then she told me something to your answer that I never knew. So I was 36 years old by then. She said, you know, I didn't choose to stay at home. I'm like, what? Like, this is like the iconic. She said, when I got pregnant with your brother in 1964, in the public school system in North Adams, Massachusetts, a community not very different than Lowell, Massachusetts, once you showed your pregnancy,
I remember that.
You went home.
That's right.
There was no choice whether you were going to work or not work. So I was 36 at the time, so 37 years earlier. In 37 years, right, we had gone from, and I know we have not made enough progress, and we're going to talk about that, but in 37 years, we had gone from somebody having no choice, and I never even knew that, to me still being frustrated, right, that there weren't a lot of good other role models for me to point to where we stand today, which I was saying to Aaron in the car ride up, I hope it's better. I do think it's better. At least there are other, I made all the mistakes, so Aaron knows the things not to do, right? But now, instead of just one person, there are others, and there are mentors. And the last thing that I think I always say is the best advice I got was, you just have to go out and be yourself and do it, whether you're first, last, in the middle, doing your best and doing what you believe in and your passion were the best pieces of advice that I was given by a whole bunch of different people, even if they hadn't done the exact thing in the exact way that I wanted to do it.
I think I really appreciate you so much, you both, for paving the way for us. I think it is getting better. We still have challenges, obviously, but I do see that it's getting better. So we have women like you both and others to thank, so thank you for paving the way. For me, growing up, I really didn't think this, but realizing now, and I didn't think this because of the fact that, so my mom first, and I didn't think this because of the fact that growing up, my parents were often working, they had multiple jobs, and we were often left alone at home. So we were always, I just felt like I couldn't do what my friends were able to do. And even though we were struggling in school, we didn't know how to communicate that, and they didn't know how to help us. So I was resentful with my parents. But in reality, understanding it now, I feel both of my parents are, they're my role models, and they've been, my mom has been a good mentor, where I feel for her to sacrifice everything to take me and walk through that jungle, that's not, she had to do what she did, and then basically she did it, and she, we came here We didn't have anything. We didn't know the language. They had to work, and they did it. And they worked, they instilled in me the values of working hard, to be persistent, and to not give up. And that's, I love who, I'm proud of who I am, and basically those were the values that they taught me. And growing up, like I mentioned, being a part of Girls Inc., I had so many women that I was able to look up to. So even though I was living in a situation where, you know, I was often depressed and, you know, I was struggling, I had someone, I had many people that I could look up to that said, that I could say, you know, that's who I want to become. I want to be just like her. I want to dress like that. I want to be in that career. And they actually, you know, even though I was struggling and they saw that, they taught me to look at it as a moment, not forever. Like, this is your moment, and you have so many opportunities. And so in turn, you know, they inspired me to dream big and to do big things. And now I totally agree with Karen, being in this community, there's so many great role models and mentors that I have, especially women. And I feel like I have many women role models and mentors in all facets of life. I just, my business, nonprofit work, at my bank, you know, because I feel like not one mentor will be able to know and answer everything and guide you or to just talk you through certain things. But I think to be able to test certain ideas with multiple people from different walks of life, I think, you know, you can make the best decision. So we're very lucky, I think, to be in this community where we have so many wonderful people, and I'm very blessed to know many of them, like Karen, that, you know, you look up to, and they have done it, and you trust them, and you can talk to them, and, you know, so we're very, very blessed.
Mentors have played a huge part in role in my life, and I'm very lucky because I've had men and women as mentors, and some happened by accident, and some I sought out. As I mentioned, Governor Swift was, I stared at her all day. Like, I just watched her and how she composed herself and carried herself under pressure, under more pressure than I think most people realize, the kinds of ridiculous questions and criticisms that a woman in a position of leadership like that should ever have to endure. She did it with grace, and I just basically studied her all day. And then from there, you know, every job I'd ever had, I was lucky that I was actually encouraged to seek out a mentor and ask people to be my mentors. So at my job at Polaroid, I had a wonderful VP of communications who took me under her wing and who let me in the room when I had no business being in the room, and is still a confidant and an advisor to me to this day. And now is a relative of mine because she happened to introduce me to her cousin, who is now my husband. She's about to find out she's going to be one of my children's godparents too. But then when I was at the Greater Boston Chamber, I had my boss at the time was a mentor. He encouraged me to seek out, and you know, folks who were on our boards, really strong women. There weren't enough of them, but there were probably a handful of women. Of the 125 people on the board of the Greater Boston Chamber at the time, I think there might have been 6 women. And I asked one of those women to be a mentor of mine, and I just would go to visit her in her beautiful office at Hill Holiday once a quarter and just pick her brain for an hour and just learned so much and soaked it all in. And I think that more than anything, the confidence to be yourself, as Governor just mentioned, the confidence to make decisions and maybe fail and learn from those failures, the confidence to take risks when I think women in particular are not encouraged to take risks, women in particular are not encouraged to run for office, they're not encouraged to go for the big job or to go for the board seat. But so to have mentors, both male and female, to encourage you to do those things and try it and see if it works. And if it doesn't work, try it again in a different way, and you'll eventually it will work. Has really helped to shape my career, my own confidence, and my ability now to advise and help women who are coming, you know, after me, which is such a pleasure and a treat because I've been such a great beneficiary of that.
So, in the speech that President Kennedy was supposed to give on the day he was assassinated, he wrote, leadership and learning are indispensable to each other. So how do you all think that modern leaders can be advocates for lifelong learning?
Do you want to start somewhere else, or?
Let's start with Erin.
Well, I think that the best leaders know that they don't know everything. The best leaders know that they need to surround themselves with people who shore up their weaknesses, and everybody has weaknesses. And they need to be confident enough to bring people with different ideas and different experiences to the table, so that not everybody's just going to say yes to you all the time. And I think, you know, without getting into any kind of political discussion, I think that there is, you know, the country can always do better when there are people who bring multiple different ideas and backgrounds to the table. And I think that that's, you know, whether it's in corporate America or political America, I don't mean to make any political statements. I just realized what I said, and it's probably conveying something that I didn't mean to convey. But it really is so important to understand that we're always learning. You know, I learn something every single day. And even if you're in a position where you can, you know, enjoy a lot of success in your career, you're still going to make mistakes, and you're still going to, you know, pick yourself for making that decision that wasn't the right decision. And so to have sort of an openness to and a humility about other people's great ideas, and knowing that you're always going to be learning something, and that's a great thing, I think it's really important.
I think it's important to model that yourself as well. So as leaders, wherever your career takes you or whatever position, and I think it's so important that you model that in a way where you're continuing to learn, you're continuing to seek feedback. Within our organization, what I really love is that, they invite us into the boardroom and ask us questions. And our CEO, when they have their strategic planning, they send it out to the whole company and asking everyone for their feedback. And then when you give them feedback, they really take the time to show that they are listening by responding and doing certain things. And of course, you know, they can't change everything, but at the same time, you feel valued that they're listening to you, they heard you, and they're doing something about it. And as a result of that, you gain confidence by saying, and this has happened to us many times, that it helped us to, and sometimes it's like, you know, our ideas aren't that great, but to know that they do care about what we think, and then that we are part of the family, and we are part of the organization, it's really important, and that helps for us to understand where we're going. And so I think it's so important to continue to learn, but I think it starts from role modeling that, and allowing others to see that, you know, we all need to learn from each other.
So I'm going to build on that. So I did an interview with someone the other day, and then I was going to a big meeting interview today. So I called that person back and said, do you have any tips for me? And she said, yes, you need to be more crisp in your answers, and they need to be shorter. Not a surprise for anybody who knows me, and so I'm going to model that here.
For me, I mean, I'm an educator by training, so, you know, if I'm not learning something, I'm not moving forward, and I think that's reflected in our organization. And what I've tried to do along with my management team is build a culture of learning. So right now we have two major initiatives we're doing. One is diversity and inclusion, because I thought we have 500 staff, and I thought, yeah, we're diverse. We have about 30 languages and dialects spoken in our organization, but it wasn't intentional enough. So it's learning from our staff. So what do we need to do to be more intentional? And just because you're diverse does not mean you're inclusive, right? So how do we do that? We also are working on succession planning and staff development, and that's embedded in our organization. So
what are people's hopes and dreams, where do they want to go, all of us, what are our next steps, and then how do we help each other get there? So what are the specific things we can do to become that next job that we might dream about? And for me, that's a really critical part for all of us in the organization, that we're always thinking about how can we help people grow, how can we help them get to the next step. I just had, in the last year, two staff leave to become CEOs at other organizations. And people are like, well, aren't you upset they're leaving? Like, no, I'm happy. Now I have friends that I can go to in other parts of the world. And that's a good thing. So I think trying to infuse lifelong learning for all of us, and that goes for me too. I take all of the webinars that we have people take as we go forward in looking at this work. So.
Thank you guys so much. So I hope you don't mind answering this one, but this one is going to be directed to Governor Swift a little bit more than the others. So California recently passed legislation to require at least one woman to sit on the board of publicly traded companies. Do you think that there are other ways that this could be done without government intervention, or is it important to, you know, give a little bit of a step along the way to help?
So I actually just posted about this on LinkedIn because I'm off social media, and so Lauren just got here, so I turned off my phone. Which is killing me, but I made an exception for LinkedIn. So I have a problem with quotas, and I'll tell you why I have a problem with quotas. Because I've been the first, and because I've been one of the first among them, it's very hard when you arrive somewhere and there are quotas, because then everyone assumes that you're not qualified to be there. And one of the things that was really empowering for me when I got elected to the state senate, and I was 25 years old, but there are 40 members of the Massachusetts Senate. And for a piece of legislation to pass the Massachusetts Senate, you need 21 votes. My vote counted for one toward the 21. So they needed my vote in 20 other votes if they wanted to pass. Not, my vote didn't count for two, my vote didn't count for half. If my legislation was going to pass, I needed 21 votes. They didn't let my legislation pass if I needed 18. I found that really empowering and as a great weapon when people assume that somehow it was, I was there because of some kind of affirmative action or because you needed more women. Having said that, it was much harder for me to get there than it was, and that's why I was only the 13th woman to ever serve in the Massachusetts State Senate in 1990, which is a travesty. So progress is not happening fast enough. Doing it through quotas is a hammer, and I worry about the people who arrive through quotas because it's already difficult when you're the first or one of the first and you are perceived to not belong, and it just makes it harder to be successful, as Aaron articulated. Having said that, we have been trying and trying and trying to get women on boards, and I hear all of the time from men, they would love to put a woman on the board if only they could find a qualified woman. And then I hear all the time from many qualified women, how do I get in? So, are there other ways? Yes, there are other ways. So, one of the things we talked about in Deloitte, what I think the folks who don't want to see California-style legislation, which has now been filed in Massachusetts, should do is to commit to at least have one qualified woman on every slate that they put forward and interview a qualified woman whenever there's an opening on their board. Oftentimes, the guys will already have a favored candidate that they will want to put forward. Then, there are now enough of us, because I'm not the only, right, who should put together our resources and make sure that when there are those openings, we find the purple speckled accountant who's got 27 years as a circus performer doing backflips in, you know, Afghanistan. And that person, because that's the qualifications they put forward, and that person is, and I'm exaggerating, obviously, but we find somebody, because there are qualified women who
who meet all of their criteria with one exception, because this is the thing you always see in any of you who have ever wanted to go on a board. The one thing that they always put on their board is, and preference will be given, or it's required, that you already have public board experience. Gee, if everybody requires you're already on a public board, I wonder how the guys got around that. Yeah, the first time. So I think that A, there needs to be, and then the other thing I would also say is a lot of large public companies don't allow the high-ranking women and men in their businesses to go on board. So the other thing that I think, and those are many of the individuals who don't want quotas, I would ask them to make an exception and to allow all of the women maybe who get to the C-level within their company to allow them to go on one corporate board, because that's the time when they're probably going to be the most desired. And once you get on one, it does become easier. But I also think once you get interviewed for one, the guys will be shocked at how many qualified women there are out there. And then the other thing is, being, so I have been on a particular board that has been all male for a long time. And in the early days, it was really, really hard. Like every question, that this is hard to believe, particularly for people who know me, but like every question I thought about asking, I would check myself sometimes like, is that a smart enough question to ask? Should I ask that question? Like, and I never do that. And I eventually moved beyond that, but you just feel the weight of not just like being worthy of being there yourself because you're the only one, but you don't want to convince all these guys. Like, you just have this perception that if you ask one dumb question, in the back of their head, they're all like, this is why we right? And they ask dumb questions all the time. One dumb question was, does the SEC, when they're asking about diversity, mean like somebody who's worked for every investment bank? Like, no, I don't think that's what they meant. So I think there are ways, but I think that I am moving closer, and Europe has a quota system as well. I would go to term limits, which I also have some issues with. But I would go to term limits, which will open up the field before I would go to quotas. But my patience, which has never been a strong suit, is waning.
So, Bopa, one of the often discussed reasons for the gender gap in company management is maternity leave. So do you think that more commonplace paternity leave could be one of the solutions to kind of solve, get more women and to lead companies and leadership of companies?
Yes.
Definitely. Personally for me, I've always been blessed to work for a company, right, that allowed me to have that, never made me feel bad. And even though I felt guilty myself, I used to always, when I first had kids, I still do, but not as much anymore, but I used to always feel very guilty whenever I'm at home. I feel like I'm not working, I'm not doing what I'm supposed to do, and then when I'm at work, I feel like I'm neglecting my kids. But, so having, first of all, having a maternity leave and a paid maternity leave is very important to have that time and to be able to come back to work and then being supported. And having people recognize that it's only, I always talk about this moment in time, right? It's this moment in time where you need that support, and then where, because you have the support, I feel that with, personally, because I have had that support, I've had my time off, I'm given time to be able to be with my kids, and I work harder, and because of that, I'm able to continue to stay with the company and grow, and being able to be where I am, as opposed to having to, you know, stay, pick and choose, you know, like, so I hope that answers your question, but I think it's very important that all women should be able to have, and even paternity leave, actually. I think fathers should be able to have time off as well, and it should be equal in that way, where then it would be more looked at as equally important that, you know, that it's equal work, right?
Right.
I hope that answers your question.
Do any of the other panelists have anything on the paternity leave question? Is it, you know, something that should definitely be looked further into as far as more commonly accepted, more commonplace, you know?
You mean paternity?
Yeah, paternity leave, yes.
Wait, did you ask me paternity or maternity?
Oh,
I'm so sorry.
Here, go ahead.
I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I thought
no,
I heard maternity. Sorry.
I'm just going to just add on to what you said. It's so important to have the family leave, you know, the expectation that it's not just mom who has to make those difficult decisions about whether they need to be home or at work or both, or on, you know, working from home or in a conference call. It's a family decision, I think. And so a more commonplace paternity leave or family leave, whatever you want to call it, is, I think, extremely important in closing that gender gap so that it's not just the woman's decision. And I think that some of the smartest companies, and there are a lot of progressive companies in Massachusetts who caught on to this, I think, before the rest of the country, started doing much more innovative and creative family leave and paternity leave solutions. And they have more, like PwC, for example, boasts, you know, one of the strongest with female leadership teams in the state of Massachusetts for a major and significant company. And they, when you look at their practices, they are very supportive of families. They're very supportive of new parents, male and female. And they have one of the best retention rates in terms of their executives. And so it's just smart. It's just good business. When people are having families, so support that, and you get to keep your best people. So 100% think that that would make a big difference if it was taken much more seriously. And just as somebody who lived for a hot minute in Europe, the maternity leave here is a joke. It's an absolute joke. I mean, the fact that, you know, yeah, 6 weeks, you know, some people who, you know, I was fortunate that I had a much more significant maternity leave, and that I was out for 3.5 months, and I still called into work every day. But the you know, vast majority of women don't have that flexibility and have to make the decision of whether or not they're going to keep their job or leave their children when they're very teeny tiny, and they're not necessarily ready to leave their children when they're that teeny tiny. Many women are, but many women aren't. So I think that we have to sort of wake up and smell the coffee and be a little bit more creative about how to keep the best and the brightest women engaged in the workforce, and I think smart companies are aware of that. You know, flexibility and creativity are absolutely important.
So I'm going to go against my giving short answers here, but I'm going to try. First of all, this is also an income inequality issue, because actually your experience is absolutely true. The data shows that people who have access to paid maternity leave actually go back to work more often, and the people who are least likely to have access to paid maternity or paternity leave are people who are lower income. And so this is actually a much bigger issue for people who have lower economic power, and that's why I think we need a more systemic solution. The other reason, and oftentimes on these issues, whether they're gender equality or pay equity, one of the things that we learned at Deloitte and other changes is when they are economic drivers and not just equity drivers, you tend to get everybody's attention. But you, a couple of months ago, there were some really interesting demographic studies that the United States is no longer having enough children in order to pay for all of us. And so we are going to not have economic growth. We're not going to be able to pay for me and all of you to retire because millennials and the next generation are, it always happens that during a time of economic contraction, people's family sizes tend to shrink. But when we have now returned to a time of economic expansion, family sizes actually haven't bounced back in the United States. We're following the patterns of Europe, and a lot of what millennials and others are pointing to is the expense of having large families. And Karen and I already, and Aaron said, we're all not guilty, but the truth is the average American woman is having less than two children, two live births, and that's just not gonna cut it. And so it's an economic imperative. And the numbers are pretty compelling. And so I think that may be what has been driving the whole issue of paid leave to become a much more resonant issue across party lines, because it's becoming, I think, an economic necessity.
So this is directed to Ms. Frederick a little bit. What do you think are the best ways for business and government agencies to help advance nonprofit work? Is it monetary aid? Is there a different way to help, you know, spur?
Well, there are lots of ways to help and to work together for business and nonprofits. And I mean, we have partnerships everywhere. And I'm thinking certainly of Enterprise Bank and our friends there. We do a lot of collaborative work together. And it's not, it is funding, certainly. I mean, we certainly depend on the philanthropy in our community that comes from business, but we also depend on the partnership and the people work, and that makes a huge difference. That is as important. People on our boards, people working on initiatives with us, the talent and the encouragement from the business sector makes a huge difference to nonprofits. So I'm thinking of an initiative we're doing right now in Lowell, and that is happening. It was launched maybe last week, and that is an initiative to work with the chronically homeless. The numbers of homeless folks has grown. We do a lot of work at my agency with families, with youth. We have a youth homeless initiative that's ongoing where we're housing young people and working with them. But the people who are on the street who are chronically homeless have grown in this area. So business came together with the city of Lowell, with the Lowell plan, and with community teamwork to really think about how to do this. So we're bringing in a consultant, and that's the time and the thinking of business, government, and nonprofits together to really get the best results. And I think when you come at a problem with all of those partners, you're going to come up with a much better solution. So we're bringing in a consultant to work with us and to move the city forward. So I applaud the city for their leadership. And our business friends from the Lowell Plan and from the Community Foundation to take this on, working with, you know, us who do the service work. So I think those partnerships are absolutely essential. I think we have a model of how that works here in this city. I can't tell you how many times I go to my business partners with a problem and say, okay, what do we do now? How can you help us move this forward? And it really is remarkable, and I think it has made us, certainly has made Community Teamwork a stronger nonprofit. I can't imagine my life without my business friends going forward. And they have been some of our biggest cheerleaders, you know. When I think back, you mentioned that, you know, you had men and women mentors, and that's the same. I mean, it was a lot of the business community. My friend George Duncan, who I knew really wanted to see me succeed. And that makes all the difference. So I think there are mentorships in the business world, there are partnerships, there are problem solving together, and I think not one sector can do it alone. So it really is powerful when we all come together.
So Bopa and Karen, you're both based in Lowell, or in the Lowell community. So what do you think some of the biggest issues that we are seeing in the Lowell community, what are those issues, and how do you think we can work to tackle those issues in the future?
Will you talk
homelessness, and for us, one of the other biggest issues is housing. Housing is a critical issue. Every 3 years, my agency does a comprehensive needs assessment of needs in the community. Housing comes out first every time. Affordable housing, it's a tight housing market here. There's about a 2% vacancy. We have a booming university. We have a vibrant city, and there's not enough places for people to live. And if you think about the rents in this area have skyrocketed. If you're making $15 or $16 or $17 or $18 an hour, think about paying, $1,500, $1,600, $1,700, and $2,000 to live someplace. It doesn't work. The number of people rent burdened, that means they pay more than 30% of their income for rent, is over 46%. That's a lot of people who are in fragile situations. So I think housing is a critical issue. And senior housing, there's an aging population, there's not enough senior affordable housing either. And that, I think, in the next few years, we're going to see that start to really ratchet up. There are more seniors who we're seeing ending up at the individual living shelter here in the city. And they don't all come from Lowell. People lose their housing. It can be an illness, a divorce, a death, and your life can spiral pretty quickly. So, and when that happens, people go where rents are a little cheaper, they come to the city. And so I think it's a challenge for all of our communities, whether it's an affluent community or not, housing is a struggle.
And I think, and to piggyback on what Karen is saying as well, in addition to housing and homelessness, the issue of mental health, we don't talk about it as often, but I think, and with a lot of the issues that not having housing and jobs and things like that, I think a lot of us and not being supported, just small things, I think it piles on that it doesn't get addressed. And I think, and it's a stigma before, and I think, and now I think we're talking about it more, and we're desensitizing it, which is good, because I think sometimes it's just, it's not even a big problem, right? It's more just being able to talk about it and address it, and it gets better. But I think the issue of mental health doesn't get talked about it, especially in this community where there's so many immigrants and refugees, where they're coming from all over and they're experiencing different things at home that we might not know, where they're coming from that we might not know about. And I think Lowell, we're such a diverse community, and we're doing such a wonderful job. And obviously, we still have we experience challenges in a way where, as I go back to being a city of a gateway city, right, and an immigrant community. I think we're, with working cities that we've developed, different organizations coming together and being a one-stop shop for people, I think we're moving ahead, or we're moving that needle. But at the same time, I think, there's different things like not being able, not knowing where to go. And because of that, it's like, and by working in this community, I see that it's so simple of just knowing the resource, right? And sometimes not knowing that resource can really put you behind. And and like I said, these are issues and challenges that we're actually already addressing, but it's just we need to continue to look at it. It's that, we have so many ethnicities, so many backgrounds, but how do we continue to be inclusive in a way of everything, right? Our government, the different positions that are within the cities, how do we look at it in a way where, for me, I think it's, first of all, it's great to have women in different leadership positions, but I also feel there needs to be more women of color in different leadership, especially in this community, because of the fact that, they do need representation. And it's important for younger people, and that's how we learn, and when we talk about how we learn from each other, it's important for them to have voices and to be able to be represented, and for young people to see, I too can do that, because someone that looks like me and understand what I'm going through. So, like I said, these are the things that we are already working on, but it's just we really need to continue to work on it, and really, how do we think about it in that way of being more inclusive and sharing that resource.
Thank you, both of you. Now for Mrs. Murphy-Rafferty and Governor Swift, do you see the same issues carried out both statewide and worldwide? Is there similarities or differences?
So I would say there are two issues that I spend a lot of time thinking. I think civility in our political discourse, which stems from the fact that not very many people spend a lot of time talking to people who hold different beliefs than they do. And I think that's something we need to bridge as a country. So that would be one thing. And then income inequality, I think, is part of that same issue, but is just, I'm glad we're only telling you what the problems are, because I think it's a very complicated issue to solve.
Yeah, I mean, I echo what all the other women say. I think that one of the things I've learned through this experience as the CEO of the Wonder Fund is that the impact of trauma on human beings, children and adults, which leads to drug addiction, which leads to mental health issues, which leads to homelessness, physical health problems. Every ailment under the sun, every societal problem under the sun can be in many ways attributed to trauma to children and adults. And so I think that sort of changing the conversation about, as opposed to what's wrong with you, or what's wrong with the person who doesn't have a house, or what's wrong with the person who doesn't have, who's addicted to opioids, for example, changing it from that to what happened to you, I think would change a lot in terms of mental health care, in terms of making sure people have the services they need, and so that's sort of my lens, my sort of unique lens in the position that I hold right now. But I think that's universal, worldwide.
So in the past, many cultures have used different myths and stories to show how women were treated and valued at the time. So how do you think history will look back on how our pop culture and media treats different women?
Bit of a jump for questions.
We have such a proliferation of media, I think it's really hard to have a single answer. I think it is a very broad spectrum. On the one hand, we have these really distorted images that unfortunately so many young women and teens with filters, and I mean, I'm guilty of it, right? It's part of the reason I'm off social media for Lent. You present a picture that nobody has any blemishes, it's only good things happening in your life, so I think, and that's not just women, but women are very susceptible to it because we're very social creatures. So I think on the one hand, you have this sort of perfection image. On the other hand, one of the good things about the proliferation of media and different outlets is more than ever before, we have women in different positions that you're seeing depicted through the media and positions of power. And I think that is really important to change the conversation. We have superheroes who are female. I think that is enormously important. I wish they might have a little bit more realistic bodies, but that'll have to be a fight for another time.
I think you're right, and I think, in some ways, it makes me think we've gone backwards, right? And if you look at a lot of the media and how women are portrayed, you think about, this is like 10 steps back. But then I look at what's happening in our corner of the world, and people are talking about it and saying how, men and women, so that this isn't okay. And I think it's causing conversations to happen at a very different level, and deeper conversations about it that we kind of never had before out loud, you know, as I think about it. But I do think some of it is pushing us back to a place where we don't want to go. And the more voices that are saying it's not okay, we need to keep saying that because it's not okay.
Yeah, I agree. I'm very fearful for my three girls. I think that the barrage of images that children see from a young age of women, it's really negative on boys, you know, and it has a negative impact on boys and girls, and it's unrealistic. But I also have hope, like the governor said, that there are a lot more women in positions of power, and my daughter has Supergirl dolls and Wonder Woman dolls, and yes, they're not wearing enough clothes, but they're strong, they have muscles now, not just curves, but muscles and curves. And so I think that there's a lot of hope, but it's just, I think we're all inundated, right? We're all like oversaturated with just crap. Unfortunately, I think, you know, the vast majority of how women are depicted, images where women are depicted in some way, shape, or form, are probably not what I would choose, you know, for my kids to be able to see.
I agree with all the ladies here, but on the other hand as well, I feel that at this moment, even though we still have a lot of work, right, I love seeing many women speaking up, speaking out, and I know obviously there's a danger in social media as well, but at the same time with social media, we see each other, we connect with each other. Look at the Women's March, right? When we have a problem, even the high school kids with, and this is obviously, this is not women, but with the high school kids, with the guns control and things like that, like, we have different marches, and we have women that are coming out and speaking out against things that, and we're actually, you know, changing for me, I do agree, but at the same time, I feel that we are, if looking back, I feel that this is the moment where I'm gonna remember many women rose up, many women woke up, right? And we all got involved, and talking about social media, we got connected, and we're more supportive of each other, more than, I feel we still have work to do, but I think we're being more mentors to each other than I've seen before. And I just like you, I'm very hopeful that that we will continue and with at least with a mean to be able to connect with each other and share. And you know, I just think about, I have a lot of young women from Cambodia that befriends me on Facebook. And obviously I don't know them, I accept them. But they see the work that I do. And because of that, you know, I get to learn about them and the culture of Cambodia, and I get that information. But I see, like, you know, I've had people that message me and says, I see what you're doing over there, and I love it, and I think it's so brave of you to, I ran for Congress last year, and I never thought of doing that. And then so people, like, wrote to, so I feel like, even though there's a danger to it, I think this is a moment where we see things that are wrong and we're able to connect better, and women are feeling empowered and they are using their abilities to do the work that they're inspired to do, and I love it.
Well, thank you guys. We have one more question. We might have time to open up to one or two questions from the audience. This one's a bit of a reflection on something. So presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin once identified five traits of a good leader that she had seen in her studies. And they were empathy, resilience, listening skills, humility, and self-reflection. So how can modern leaders exemplify these? Sorry.
Maybe we should each take one.
So empathy?
Know in how you operate. I think you have to be empathetic, and you are, you know, I guess I think in particular women have strength in this area. You know, we often are the caregivers of our parents. We take care of kids. All those things that women do, I think, give us a particular strength in being empathetic to other people. And I think it is part of, you know, part of being in charge is saying, okay, well, we can do this, but we may be able to do it in this way, right? You don't always have to come down hard, and you don't always have to have a rule for everything. It's about judgment and about thinking through. And I think that is about empathy and really thinking about how that plays out as a leader. And I do think it is one of the things that women in particular bring to the table from our experiences in life.
So Governor said that would give you resilience?
I don't know who said this, but it wasn't me. But light a candle rather than cursing the darkness. And no one goes through life without bad things happening to them. And you could look at, and Doris Kearns Goodwin wrote only about presidents as political leaders. But the reality is that there are community leaders here, political leaders at every level. And I am here to tell you that not every aspect of political leadership is awesome. But if I had it to do over again, I would. And I was given so many honors that people never saw, right? To impact kids in foster care, to extend tuition to kids who aged out of the foster system, to impact the standards that we set for our public education system so that kids who grew up in places like North Adams and Lowell could know whether or not the education they were getting was as good as the kids who grew up, no offense, in Chelmsford and Newton and places where their parents had a lot more money. But you only do that if you step into the ring. And rather than bemoaning the state of federal politics today, step in, right? Get involved. And if you don't succeed the first time, set your sights on coming back and making a difference in a different way, in a different manner, in a different place, because there are lots of places that you can make a difference, that you can light a candle, and folks who sit around and curse the darkness or complain about all the bad things that happen to them don't make the world a better place.
So, Ms. Malone, what would you say about the value of self-reflection?
I think it's so important to always check in with yourself, right? Check in and at every level to, as a good leader, I think, at any level, you should always check in and not even just with a self-reflection, asking people around you, like people that you're leading or people that are above you, it doesn't matter, like doing a 360 kind of reflection of how are you might be leading well on one aspect, but you know, certain things you're not, and being able to be open to that and say, you know what, I do want to learn, I do want, I accept that I'm not perfect, I don't know everything. And I am learning as well, and you know, so I think it's very important, and I think it's always important to personally for me, I do that with my mentors, and I do that when I was a I don't manage right now, but when I was a manager, I do the same thing, and I think sometimes I always feel like I'm doing so well, everything's so great, but then when you ask these questions and you really when you do ask them, you have to accept the fact that some of the answers might not be good, and you can't, like, you know, you are doing this because you want to learn yourself and not, you know, you're not expecting to hear every good thing about yourself. So if you accept that, I've grown so much. I've become a better, stronger person by hearing all these things, and I seek those now. It's like I don't really go to the people that give me great things about myself anymore. It's like I want you to tell me what's not good, because that's how you improve.
So, Mrs. Murphy Rafferty, would you, you know, reflect on listening skills? I know you've talked a lot about, you know, having mentors, and also you're the head of a very large nonprofit. How do you implement listening into the community that you work with?
Well, I would like to talk about my most crushing defeat professionally when I think about listening, because it was also the greatest thrill ride of my life, and I learned a lot by about the power of listening and the importance of listening through this experience. I don't think I really touched on it, and it was completely an accident in my introduction. But I ran the day-to-day operation for Boston 2024, which was the Olympic bid that was trying to get the Summer Olympics to Boston and Greater Boston and Massachusetts. And right before I took the Wonder Fund job. And it was a phenomenal experience, and it was a great learning opportunity for me in so many ways, and got to travel the world and meet so many people. But I also learned very acutely the importance of not only listening and active listening, but also reinforcing the importance and appearance of being a listener. And I think as we went through the bidding process, which obviously we all know is ultimately not successful, we realized that it was very extremely important to show the communities that were going to be impacted by this, the Olympic Games in 2024, if they were to be held in Massachusetts, that we cared about how it was going to impact them, and we cared about the lasting, you know, results of hosting an Olympic Games long after the Games are over. What does that mean to people who live here for their whole lives? So I think that one of the things I'm proudest of in that experience, and it was truly the most amazing thrill ride of my life, and I wouldn't trade it for a second, even though not every day was easy. But I think that we were able to, through the Boston experience, Boston 2024 experience, I think we were able to shift the conversation and shift the business model of the U.S. Olympic Committee, which invites cities to bid, and did not want an open process up until a certain point, so that we were able to sort of win the U.S. bid, so we could be the U.S. representative internationally for the race for the Olympics. And I think that because of what we learned through the Boston 2024 experience, the OSOCs changed their model. And I think that the biggest thing was, let's listen to the community before we start to prescribe what's the best thing for the community. And Governor Swift knows this better than anybody, that it's really, really important to not be the one talking in the room all the time, to sit back and hear what people have to say. And I think that I will carry that experience with me for the rest of my life, in big ways and small, from an organizational point of view to a personal point of view. You cannot underscore the importance of listening enough.
Yeah, well, thank you all for that. And is there anybody who has any questions?
Hi, my name is Valerie. I'm Maldonado. I've been in the city council. The first Hispanic female to run here in the city of Lowell. I would like to know more about your board, because we've been working with CTI around Christmas time. I built our organization, my family, and efforts. I'm an advocate of Brooklyn City. I'm also a scientist with dual diagnostics from Virginia State University. So we deal with a lot of low aliens, which is the low homeless people. And we've been sending that to Pittsburgh, Worcester, Birmingham, but we have a list that we can't keep our own people here. And this is very saddens me. I'm also a victim of, I help out the gang unit also, because my son was a victim of a gang shooting last year in April. He was a 23-year-old that got blown out of Delta. So originally from Brooklyn, New York. I came to this city. I loved it. To me, it was a little country town, except for Brooklyn, New York. It's like, what are these people complaining about the projects? The same projects. but from the 1990s to now, it saddens me. You know, it looks like a little Brooklyn. And you know, I really want to make change, and I enjoy seeing all these women coming around, and just the unity. You know, what's going on in Loma, I can tell you what's going on. I'm out there 2, 3, 4 in the morning, chasing these young girls off the streets. I bring them into hotels instead of shelters. I detox them and I watch them and I dialogue it and I send it out. We do home-based treatment and it's been working. We haven't had death or suicide since 2012. I did not choose to run. The community went together when I had surgery 3 weeks ago and asked me to run. Do you know what's that 18 people in your bedside asking me to help them make a change? So I ask you, because you're in CTI, not to boast, because the things I do not boast. So very Christian. We've been helping CTI since 2012. And I'd really like to get on your board, because I am the owner of Advocates of Within City.
Well, I would love to talk to you. I mean, I would. Our board is made up.
I need help, and I'm tired.
Yeah, well, I'll give you my card, and come have a conversation with me. Our systems are trouble. I mean, a lot of our systems don't work well together, and that's the work we're trying to do at Community Teamwork, to really put them together.
Yes.
You know, like the mental health system doesn't talk to the substance abuse system well, and there's not a clear path through anything. You know, when we decided to really try to change our organization was when I realized I was working, our case management team was presenting a case, and this family had 8 caseworkers. Who in the world needs 8 caseworkers?
Nice.
Telling them 8 different things, 8 different family plans, and my guess is the family had no input in any of those plans. Some of them were state agencies, some of them were my staff, some of them were other agency staff. That's not helpful. It's not how we should operate, it's not dignified and respectful, and it doesn't work. So we're really trying to transform how we work and how we work with other agencies by bringing together folks. My board right now is that our board is interesting because it's mandated by the federal government to be set up this way. So it's a third public officials who sit on my board, and currently I have 3 city councilors from Lowell. It's a third private sector, and then a third low-income folks or agencies representing low-income people. So it is a board that, to me, holds me true to the work that we do in the community. Because it is a collaboration of the private sector, government, and people who receive our services. So I would love to talk to you, and I'm so sorry to hear about your son.
Oh, it's okay. It's my life. We move forward. We move forward.
Yeah, and you know, having voices from the community is what is part of the work that we do. And if we're not doing that, we're not doing our jobs right. So
correct.
I would talk to you about that.
Congratulations on the candidacy.
Thank you, Mom. You inspired me. Watching you last year, helping you out, really inspired me.
Thank you.
Thank you. You're brave.
So, do we have any other questions?
I'm going to start. So, I want to thank first of all, I want to thank the organizers for this opportunity and all of the panel. Extremely privileged to be here. I am a grad student at UMass Lowell from Nigeria, and believe me when I say it's an opportunity to be here in this room here in the United States, to have like hardworking parents who, even against the backlash of friends, like why would you send a girl to send a girl to school, get a kid in the United States, and really I'm privileged. And you know, a lot of you talked about mentorship, and that's one thing that I've been working on since I came here. You know, knowing that I satire in this time, and you know, struggling with the economic and the cultural shock, and you know, just striving to like get to you know, not be complacent. You know, a lot of times back home, growing up back home, I've seen a lot of women just be comfortable with the opportunities that they got, like the little opportunities that they got, and I've never really had that person to look up to, like push me, like, yeah, you can get a dream, like that desire, that goal that you have is achievable. And you know, seeking out mentorship, I think that's really key. But you know, I've had a little bit here and there, like professors like guide me through one or two things and say, oh, you need to be more comfortable in this area and learn to speak like that and things like that. But with mentorship, I realized that even though people, it's not like people are not willing to mentor, a lot of people are busy. So how do you develop mentorship and like build relationships, sustainable relationships, especially for women and like young women in college, and you know, just developing like a secret to developing like strong mentorship and relationship for women.
So first of all, you're so brave to stand up and make that speech and to go to a different country and speak a different language. So whatever you think you don't have in terms of a vision, there's something that you do have because you and your parents are seeking that out. And so I would say, and I don't remember who said it, but you can take different pieces of mentorship and sponsorship from different people. I think you said you connected with some of your professors. One of the things I always tell, the eyes are gonna roll, so I'm not gonna look that way, but I always tell my own daughters, is a lot of students I've taught actually at the college level, and students always come in at like those critical times, like right before a paper's due, right before midterms. So go and find your professors early in the semester, they, during office hours, or if you can't make it to their office hours, send them an email. If you know what your major is going to be, send an email to the head of the department and ask if there's a time you can meet with them. Ask them what the most successful students in the department, what courses they took, which internships they held. So one of the things to do is to find those parts of success that are closest to where you are right now by reaching out to people. And I tell young women this all the time, when you ask people very specific questions, right? Like, so you ask the head of the department or the head of career services, like, what's, you know, I don't know if you know what you want to do or you know what subject you love. I love math. You know, what is the most interesting internship you've seen a math student at UMass Lowell do? Who did they talk to? You get to ask specific questions, and then the people who give you back specific answers, that's the way you start to build a relationship. But when you ask people for something specific, the only bad thing that can happen is they can say no, and no doesn't really hurt. And sometimes when people say no, like, no, I don't have enough time, they're still impressed. They're like, oh, I need, and I didn't catch your name. What?
Favor.
Okay, I'm not going to pronounce it right, so I'm not going to
try. Do me a favor.
Okay, favor. Oh, now I got, see, that's right. I'm going to say favor. I wasn't able to help Favor get that internship, but the next time I see an internship, I'm going to remember Favor. Like, she asked me that really interesting question, or she really wanted to get into that class, or she's really going the extra mile. And so I think people mentor those students, those young people in the organization. So Aaron said, oh, the person took me into the room that I had no business being in. Well, Aaron also probably was spending extra time, right? And going into that room and then probably doing her work she was supposed to do by staying later another time. So the mentor had the confidence, I can pull Erin into this meeting because her direct supervisor isn't gonna be mad at me because she's still going to do her other work. So everything becomes you build confidence by what you ask for, and then you continue to build that relationship. But ask people, like, that's always the best question, whoever you find, like, what is the most successful person you worked with? What did they ask you to do for them? If you don't know what to ask, right? Like,
oh, you know, what has your most successful student, you know, done in the summer? Or which classes did they take? Those are good questions when you don't know what the question is to ask.
So Karen and I talked about this earlier, and I think, I don't know if you ladies came yet at that point, but we were talking about exploring. When you first start out, right, you say yes to everything and you explore different things. So for me personally, because I said yes to everything and I was able to connect with so many people, I was able to observe them and see, okay, these are the skills that I want to learn. So from this person, Erin, I definitely want to learn from her the business skills. And for Jane, I would love to ask her to be my mentor for political things and things like that. So I think one person can't be it all. So kind of like, because you're, and it's, Jane said this, building relationship, but also building trust in a way of, you know, you see these people, you know, okay, these are areas that you would like them to mentor you on. And then also, I think it's like dating. Sometimes it's not gonna work. You're gonna have mentors that probably will say something to you that you know yourself that's not, even though they meant well, they're probably, because from where they came from and what they experienced, they're gonna tell you something that they love you, but it's not what you are meant to, and you have to know that yourself and to feel your, trust your intuition that this is not what I, you know, want. Or, but there's certain ways, I think it's setting that expectation as well and saying up front, you know, like, I would love you to be my mentor on this aspect, and this might be a certain, like, you know, I might need this much of your time. Can you commit to that? And you yourself have to be proactive, though. You have to be the one to reach out and to ask those questions and to learn from those when you're testing those out, like I said, to really trust, and then learn to trust yourself as you go along. That, you know, and know that all of your mentors will mean well, but it's just at the end of the day, you're gonna know that based on all of those talks that you've talked about, it's gonna be you and what you feel in here, and it's hard, but it's...
I was just gonna say, don't be afraid to ask, because, you know, I've had people say, well, you're too busy, I couldn't ask you to do that. If somebody says they're too busy, it's not the mentor you want anyway, right? I find the busiest people will find time for the important things. So, you know, don't think, well, I can't ask that person because they're too busy. They'll tell you if they are. And I think, you know, often the people you really want look busy and are busy, but if it's something important, they will take the time to do it. So don't be afraid to hear, as Jane said, no, because, you know, that's just part of the process.
Honored.
That's right. And people are honored to want to someone to work with them.
And even if they aren't, so right. I had a fundraiser who said to me, just pretend, like, people are flattered when you ask them for a lot of money. Like, that might not be true, but I'm going to choose to believe it.
That's exactly right. That's
true. Put yourself in the path of, you know, people you want to know. So, you know, go for the internships, go for, you know, volunteer at different organizations, go to networking events, and then be brave enough to ask. Like they said, no, doesn't really hurt as much as you think it's going to hurt. And you have four people up here who would be honored to be a mentor to somebody as amazing as you. So just, that's a great start. And think about, you know, I don't know what your path is in life and what you're interested in doing, but who are the CEOs of those, of the top companies in the industry you're interested in? And go get an internship and be yourself and be amazing, and they're going to say yes because you're being so proactive.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
So thank you all so much for coming to this event tonight. We really hope you enjoyed the panel and learned something new. And we really want to thank all of our really great panelists for being with us tonight. And our sponsors, the Merrimack Repertory Theater and Mr. and Mrs. Drew Photography for help making the event possible tonight. And we want to thank our school, our teachers and administration for coming out to support us tonight.
also our volunteers, Sarah and Aiden and Daniel, I think, and the Great Wall Community Foundation and the staff of Middlesex Community College for helping us set this all up tonight. And we want to thank our families who are here tonight for their support, and we want to wish my mom and Aiden, Britta's brother Aiden, a happy birthday today. Check out our website at leadersinlowell.org and keep an eye out for future events. So, thank you all for coming.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Lessons in Leadership, our Women in Leadership discussion.
You can find more content like this, featuring more leaders in leadership discussions, wherever you listen to your podcasts, and at our website, leadersinlowell.org, for more information on this event and our series.
Thanks for listening.
Bye.